welcome to Everyone's an Expert with me, Dr. Alex D. It's been a little bit of a break since the last podcast because of reasons, but here we are back with a vengeance. Thanks to those of you that have asked where it's been. I appreciate that. I'm very excited to be talking today to Amy Weber, who is a singer, songwriter and comedian, not necessarily in that order. And I'm really looking forward to speaking to Amy. Just a little peek behind the curtain of the process. I'm actually recording this genuinely before speaking to her, so there is a true sense of chronology to this podcast rather than me just faking it. Anyway, that's enough of me wanging on. Here is Amy Weber. Amy, welcome to Everyone's an Expert. Thanks for joining me, mate.
Thanks for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure. I'm really glad that you said yes. I have been admiring your oeuvre via social media for some time, so it's nice to talk to you. But for the benefit of listeners, what do you do? What are you doing?
I'm getting to grips with how to introduce myself, actually.
Because I should say as well, it's kind of a shitty question, but
yeah, it's
one of the things I'm most interested in about you is the fact that you are kind of operating in a couple of different spheres. And yeah. So therefore, I retract the apology. It was legitimate, but only
no,
in the context.
No, it was. You're right. Okay, so I'll start with what I say now, and then I'll do what I used to say. So I am a musician. I'm a singer. I'm a songwriter. I write children's songs for publishers, and I'm a comedian. That would probably be what I'd say.
I recorded the intro to this beforehand, yeah. And I sort of said that in that order, but I corrected myself and I said I'm not necessarily sure that that is the order. Is that kind of the chronological order, but not necessarily the current?
Exactly, it's sort of the chronological order. It's also sort of the order in which I make most money on, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, sure.
Because the comedy right now only makes it doesn't make much money. It's like, 4% of my income. But I'm just too scared to say comedian first because I've only been doing it for 3 years. I haven't got really professional gigs. You know, like in the music world, you wouldn't call yourself a musician if you had a 9-to-5 and then did like a wedding once a month with a band from school who were all amateur musicians. You wouldn't say first, I'm a musician, would you?
You'd say the other job first. Yeah.
So it's a bit like that for me. In the comedy world, I am still quite new, even though I'm really good.
Well, yeah, and a lot of the stuff that I mentioned that I've seen on social media is probably, certainly the stuff that I remember the most is the comedy stuff or the stuff that is comedy adjacent. So I guess that's another peculiar addition to that, isn't it? That the way that you see the balance of what you do isn't necessarily the same as an individual member of your audience, if you like.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, the comedy maybe makes sense to them or feels like the most authentic version of me on stage or even maybe me in social situations. So, yeah. And in a way, I've always been trying to make people laugh. That's been the essence of my sort of social interactions since I've been really, really young. So comedian fits me well. I just feel like a bit of a fraud when I say it. So right. I want to say musician and songwriter because, you know, that's where my training was and that's where most of my income comes from. But if I'm having a bad day, I sort of say I'm a musician. You know, I teach one day a week and I have some private students and I sort of go on about my teaching and then I'm like, oh, and I perform, you know, I sing at weddings and sort of sometimes do comedy gigs and I make it sound like they're just hobbies.
But it's funny how you switch that because I've done the same thing having had, I guess, kind of multiple jobs on the go at the same time. Sometimes you get a sense of, but what's the answer this person kind of wants to hear or is going to make this the easiest?
Yeah, make this social interaction easier, because sometimes you don't want loads of questions and you don't want to come across arrogant. And when someone sort of says, I'm in a marketing job that I hate, you don't want to then come in and be like, oh, I'm a freelance self-employed songwriter who does comedy, you know, because then you just come across like smug and smarmy.
Yeah, but on the other hand, good for you. You should
Yeah,
do.
On the other hand, fuck it.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, so I've spent years of my life trying to underplay my confidence because I don't want to come across too confident, because that's crass, especially in a woman. And now I'm sort of growing back into that and being like, it's fine to be like, I'm good. Anyway.
Do you think that sense of wanting to underplay the quality of what you do can come from all kinds of different places. But do you think the gender thing is the primary thing there?
I think the gender thing is really key, because just societally, when you say you're good at something, as a kid, often you are told, like, don't say that, it's a bit showy-offy. Whereas boys are quite celebrated for being show-offs. I mean, it's just like the classic sort of he's a good leader versus like she's bossy. There are a lot of connotations of men in leadership positions being quite powerful and women in leadership positions being sort of bitchy or smarmy or bossy. So I think being proud of what you do also comes into that. I guess maybe it's a bit of a class thing too. Like, I do have quite a middle class sounding voice, and although my family weren't rich, you know, in many ways we were privileged, and you know, so I guess I also don't want to come across really confident, because it might make me seem even more privileged. I don't know. That's, I mean, this is a whole nother topic there, isn't it?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I a lot of that, well, no, obviously not the gender thing. A lot of that resonates, though, and resonates with things that conversations I've had with either students or other fellow professionals. And it's quite a lot of unlearning to do to break some of those habits, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think that I often wonder as well whether there is a British thing going on there as well, but then I think again, I don't know, I'm only thinking from my own experience, I think the gender thing is probably the strongest thing. But I think on top of that, there is a certain Britishness, isn't there, to not wanting to do that. I'm thinking of American colleagues I have, and how much more natural their whole kind of instinct for self-promotion is.
Yeah.
But even that makes it sound like I'm being kind of snide and a little bit shitty about it. It's just totally different.
Yeah. No, and self-promotion's good. I mean, it's a shame. I don't know what age you reckon you were able to say, I'm good at this, or be more bold about self-promotion. But for me, it wasn't at uni. It wasn't during my master's. It was since then. And it is definitely a societal and British thing that you're not taught to do it, and it's not really celebrated. It's just seen as a bit crass and egotistical.
Yeah, it's tough, but it's difficult, because you're also wanting to simultaneously project the level of confidence that makes people feel comfortable when you're on stage.
Exactly. Yeah, because otherwise people think you're shit.
But so I guess, and I'm not trying to kind of really smoothly segue this, but it strikes me that I guess humour is a really good way of kind of trying to demonstrate and project the confidence, but in a way that also deflects from it necessarily being about how great you are. I can imagine, for instance, that's, I don't know, it's like, it's always the cliched Billy Connolly route into comedy, but is that a little bit how it's been for you?
Yeah, definitely. Someone quite early on said to me about comedians, or clowns in particular. Clowns are a type of comedian, not necessarily the red nose type clown, but they said, yeah, to be a comedian, you have to be talented. So you build yourself up and you want to ultimately show the audience your talent, but you also want to bring yourself down. And so one of the best things, I think the best ways I show that in a, you know, to explain it really briefly, is in my set, I sing opera. And I want to show the audience that I sing opera. It's a bit novel. It's kind of funny. But before I sing my 2 bars of opera, I say, I've got an opera degree that's never been useful. And then I sing 2 bars of, you know, quite high notes that are supposed to be impressive. And so it's that showing a talent but dragging yourself down. And it's the same with the singing. You know, I sing and show the audience my CV because the gag is I don't have enough freelance work. And I still stand by that. And maybe in 2 years I will stop doing that set because I might have enough freelance work, but it certainly never feels like it's going to get to the stage where I'm turning down opportunities.
I guess as well, there's you don't necessarily need to do away with material that was once true. Just because it's not, you know, that thing of like first, second, third person authenticity.
Yeah.
Like I often think about that with, I mean, here's the Springsteen klaxon because I'm always banging on about Springsteen. But, you know, it's been many, many decades since he was, in fact, he was never really a working man. He was always just playing in bars, but he found a way to voice that particular thing. It had the ring of truth about it and therefore it still is authentic, even though it's never actually been his life. So basically you can be Springsteen is what I'm saying, Amy.
Thank you so much.
So what was there a kind of decisive point at which, I'm still talking about the comedy here, a decisive point at which you went, right, I'm going to define myself as this now, or I'm going to seek out a gig? What was the genesis of that?
I did a performance where I was showing off my singing. There were going to be some agents there, and this is a time where I was trying to get work in theatre, being a musical... Oh, I've forgotten what they're called. An actor-musician, that's the term. And, you know, they said, can you just sing a song that shows off your singing? So maybe shows off a bit of jazz or a bit of opera, a bit of musical theatre, a bit of pop. So I wrote this two-minute song. And because I was showing off my singing, I had to take the piss out of myself too, so it wasn't so crass. And I performed it to my peers and some agent-y people, and everyone laughed, and I didn't think it was that funny. But of course, the moment people laugh, it's such a buzz. It really is a buzz for me. Having sung or done dance when I was little and performed most of my life, I love it when an audience clap, you know, when they're clapping, when they're listening, when I've got them in the palm of my hand. Or, you know, a few roles I've done where it's sad and I've made the audience cry. But making the audience laugh tops it all. And so when I did this song, I just got a taste for it. And someone said, you should do that at a comedy night. And I was like, oh, I'm not a comedian. I'm a singer and a musician. And I'd only really just got to the point of being able to call myself a musician. Only in the last 2 years have I been able to call myself a songwriter. Still too scared to call myself a producer, but maybe in the next year I'll be able to say producer as well. And so I did a few more comedy gigs. I think it wasn't till after lockdown when I moved to London. So that was September 2021. That's when I really started to say comedian or wanted to be a comedian. And I realised that if I work my way up, really up, that I could make money out of this industry, especially if I get onto radio and TV, which is my aim.
Cool.
Does that answer it? That was a bit
absolutely
boring,
yeah.
Actually.
No, that was brilliant. No, is it as fun as it looks? Because it always strikes me that I get that thing that it's an incredible buzz when it goes well. It also strikes me that it's you're making yourself pretty vulnerable by doing that. Whereas with music, we can quite often not hide behind, but you're part of the material is part of it. Even if you've written it, it's like you can go, well, you know, it's these chords and objectively, I know these things work. Whereas I guess with comedy, it's a lot more sort of, what's the word? I don't know. It's harder to objectify what is funny, isn't it? Because it can be it's not necessarily, you can't transcribe funny, can you?
No. I mean, there's two things there. One is that I think you're very vulnerable when you're performing comedy, but I also think you're vulnerable when you're fronting a band. And so I guess I've had a relative amount of experience in that, not loads, but, you know, a few years. And you do have to chat to the audience. You do need the audience somewhat to like you. You have to know what to say, when to say it. You have to be the sort of spokesperson between the immense talent on stage and then the sort of normal non-musicians on the floor, not on the floor, in the audience, just in
the understanding.
That's the peasants. No. And then you do feel like you're getting judged on your singing. So, you know, it's, I get what you're saying about if the audience aren't maybe enjoying a gig so much, you can blame it on the chords, or, but I bet as a player, you'd quite rarely blame it on your tone. Whereas for singers, I think a lot of the time, if people aren't feeling it, you might go, oh, you know, was I flat in that song? It's because I couldn't belt those high notes in that Ariana Grande song. I had to do them in a mixed head voice. Or it's because my riffs, I cut out that Beyonce riff because I couldn't do it. So I did a more
and
basic one.
And that's the reason. Yeah, no, I totally get that. I mean,
that's the reason. So it is quite, yeah. I think you are still vulnerable then. And then in comedy, yeah, it's an extension of all of that. And it is harder because it's literally just you. You're speaking to the audience, telling them what you think is funny and what you think is interesting. And so if you misjudge that, it's embarrassing. It's like going to a party and thinking you've made friends and then at the end of the night hearing behind your back, like, that Amy girl was like really weird, or like really boring, or really annoying, or a complete show-off who wasn't funny. I mean, those are some of the words that are sort of, you know, words of nightmares for me. If I heard anyone say that about me, I'd be so mortified because I want people to think I'm funny and nice and fun, and maybe a bit dry. But the lucky thing for me about comedy is I don't do straight stand-up. I do musical comedy. So if nothing else, people are always entertained by my singing and the music, and it's a bit different. And so as a result of that, I've never really... It's called bombing. I guess you know that in the comedy world. And I have seen people bomb. I've gone into sort of competitions or gigs where I've been like, ooh, you know, he's done this competition or he's won that or he did something for ITV or BBC, so he's going to be really good. And then sometimes the audience just don't like you and they sort of don't really clap very much and they're really quiet. But I have to say, it actually hasn't happened to me. And I'm not saying that's because I'm good. I just think there hasn't been an audience yet who haven't in some way appreciated someone sort of singing on stage and being moderately funny. Some audiences are louder than others, but I've never come off stage and been like, that was not good. They didn't like me at all. And that's lucky. And maybe I've got a tough one coming.
Well, it's just so interesting as a comparison with your journey of development in musical performance, or maybe in something like dance or another performance art, is that I'm always fascinated when I hear about when I hear comedians talk about their process, and a lot of kind of I don't know what you'd call it, I guess kind of traditional stand-ups talk about that bombing thing as a sort of necessary rite of passage. It's kind of where you it's kind of part of how you improve, part of how you learn to be bold and read moments and things like that. It just fills me with admiration for people that can be so, I guess, kind of scientific about something that in the moment must be really kind of
tough.
Could be a little bit traumatic, you know.
Yeah.
Certainly, for where your self-value is concerned.
Yeah.
I think it can
really put you off.
I think I read Jack D's book, and I think it was in his book. He said that the problem that you've got when you just stand up with a microphone is that you're essentially saying, before you even open your mouth, I think I'm funny. And that's hard, isn't it? Because you've really got to follow through on that.
Yeah.
It's harder than just like, I think what I'm about to say is interesting, or I've been asked to come here and talk about this thing because the other person thinks I'm the right person to speak to. It's different to a lot of other transactions like that, isn't it?
Yeah. And another thing someone said to me is related to that of I think I'm funny is bringing it back to gender. You know, fancy a woman who thinks they're funny. It's like even more someone who I've worked with, a mentor, Morag, she said to me, you know, you get on stage and the audience see you and they know that you have the audacity to believe you're funny. And the word audacity to me was so, it just really rang true because it's different to Jack D. You know, when I'd spoken about this on a podcast I did a few weeks ago with someone, and it is like when you walk on stage, or even when the compere says, and the next person, Amy Webber, you can see the audience literally go,
a woman.
And like, even if it's subconscious, and God, I mean, I probably still do it myself, where you go, oh, I wonder if they're going to be good or not. With a man, it's sort of like, who is it? What's their set about? There's still this expectation that there's a sort of 50% chance it might be really shit. That's all, like, you know, subconsciously. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I think it lives in a lot of people subconsciously. And yeah, when you get on stage and have the audacity to think you're funny, it takes a lot.
But it's weird as well that's kind of a thing that audiences go through. Because in a way, there's a certain logic that says, actually, the percentages of a female comedian being really good are probably higher.
Yeah.
Because you've already been through, all of those barriers to get to that point in the first place.
Yeah. I just coughed into the microphone. I just coughed into the microphone. Hope you're listening to this, Alex D. They don't call me a musician and a comedian for nothing. I'm singing in the interval of our podcast. Yeah. I'm singing. Now I've got distracted because I'm on my phone. I'm checking my updates on WhatsApp. Ooh. Okay, well, I'm still recording. I sang a little song in the break. Shall I do another fishbone for the sake of your editing?
Yeah, please do. I enjoyed the first one.
I'm going to do one anyway. Let me get it up so I can look at how it's looking. Okay. It's really good.
That's amazing. Thanks very much.
Yeah, it looks brilliant. I'm going to take a photo of it.
Well, I was going to say, I'm going to leave that in, and I'll maybe use that as an image to advertise this episode.
Okay, yeah. Well, yeah, it's quite bad though, isn't it?
Oh, no, it's a thing of beauty. It's great.
It also, if you put it that way, it looks like one of those, if you put it sideways, like one of those toys that you throw hoops onto.
Oh, yeah.
Do kids play that? Anyway, let's not talk about generational games.
Right.
Okay,
launching back in.
Yeah.
You mentioned about the producing thing, and I'm keen to talk about that. I hear what you're saying about sort of being reticent to define yourself as a producer. But one of the things that strikes me about your ability to put content out is that ability to produce yourself. Whether that's the those songs you're doing regularly for BBC Manchester, and quite a lot of the other stuff that works really well on social media, I guess that ability to deal with video, deal with audio, enables you to get that out there, right?
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't have done any of the jobs I'm doing now before lockdown because I couldn't even use Logic. I didn't even know, or Ableton. You know, I didn't know how to plug in a microphone.
It's as recent as that.
I didn't. Yeah, really recent. So I started my master's in pop music in 2019, September. Mm-hmm. And my teacher sort of said, you should try and get your head around Logic or Ableton. And I was just like so resistant. I remember ringing my mum and actually crying on the phone and saying like, I don't want to do technology. I just want to like be a singer and be a performer. Why do I have to use computers? And, you know, I had some kind friends at the time who used their time to help show me Logic and Ableton.
That's a quick turnaround from being in that position in 2019.
Yeah.
I think...
Well, lockdown came at a good time
Yeah, right.
for me.
Yeah. I mean, ironically, because I guess it was from the perspective of your master's, did you do it for a year or 2 years?
Yeah, I did the 1 year intensive, but 6 months of that was in person. And then obviously the last few months were lost to COVID, you know, March, April, May, June. And the course would have ended in July anyway, early July. But yeah, it came at a time where I guess me and sort of shout out to my ex-boyfriend, Zach Okonkwo, who, you know, we were living together during lockdown and we were both trying to get our heads around Logic and recording. He's a drummer, so he was getting into drum mics and drumming EQ. And I was getting my head around the difference between a condenser mic and a dynamic mic, or what EQ even means, what compression means, what it does, how it works. And now, I didn't see not doing tech as a barrier to producing and releasing content, but of course it was. And the thought of trying to do comedy stuff now, you know, and thinking of a good song, but needing someone to help me write it, to help me record it, to help me edit the video. Not that my video editing's any good, but it's fine. It does its job.
I think that's the other thing that you learn about a lot of these things, because I guess, I imagine this is probably the same for your children's songwriting as well, is that it needs to be good enough to get the idea out there and for people to understand what it is you're trying to do. And in a lot of cases, actually good enough is easily good enough. That's not to say that there isn't a place for people being experts, but I think in today's environment where people are self-producing a lot more, that's a good thing, because it means that everybody has the tools, if they want to learn, to get their stuff out to a higher level. And I think it also means that the quality of what you hear production-wise when it is at the elite level is even higher than it ever was, because necessarily you need to be really shit hot to distinguish yourself from everybody else that can bash away in Logic.
Yeah, exactly.
But I find that really interesting that that was your position as far back as recently as 2019. But I'm not guessing at your age, but I think we're a similar age. Yeah, the situation I think a lot of us that are maybe in our 30s were in when we studied music was that was still a thing. There was still a distinction between the production guys and the performance guys, which is partly to do with access to the gear and the kit and whatever, but I think it was definitely an ingrained attitude. And through the time...
And in my era, it was even deeper. It was the production guys, the musician guys, and then the singer women.
Oh, yeah. I didn't even think of that.
Don't forget about them. You know, like, course, that was where I was. I didn't know how to use an interface. And every time I went into the studio, I didn't know what was going on. They were like, okay, sing now. And that's all I could do.
But interestingly, it's one of those kind of patriarchal things that I think the guys used to like that.
They'd moan about it. I don't want to blame them.
I'm not thinking of individual blokes. I'm thinking of possibly being in that situation as well.
Yeah, it's like, and just sort of...
You know, you get a kick out of knowing more than someone else, or, you know, it makes you necessary or whatever.
Yeah.
But what's really interesting, I don't know if you noticed this by being... when you were doing the masters, but during my time teaching at undergraduate level, which started in about 2013, and I haven't been doing it the last couple of years, but over those 7 or 8 years, in terms of the attitude of 18-year-olds, massive shift, hugely accelerated by lockdown, but it was going on before that, which is really encouraging to see. It also makes me jealous that I wasn't 10 or 15 years younger,
because
I had exactly the same thing. But it's like all of these guys come in and are using Logic as a songwriting tool, even if they play a guitar. They're like, well, I can do more stuff. I've got the whole universe of sound here with the DAW. Why would I not use that? I can make a full track immediately. And it's like, oh yeah, obviously.
Yeah.
So it is good to see that.
Writing songs in your room because I actually got GarageBand when I was really young. Someone told me to get it. And I managed to get my head around it in my teens. And I would write songs on the piano and put in a really basic drum beat on GarageBand and record myself through the laptop speaker.
Yeah.
I didn't have a mic. I didn't have an interface. And then obviously I went and studied opera for 4 years. And in that time, I didn't open GarageBand. I stopped songwriting. But it makes me a bit annoyed to think, oh, if I'd, in another universe, if I was 10 years, you know, my birth was delayed by 10 years, and then I'd gone straight into doing an undergrad. I mean, I think when I was 16, 17, I could have auditioned and got into Brit School. Honestly, I think I could as a singer and a songwriter. But I didn't even know Brit School bloody existed.
Yeah.
And even if I had gone, I wouldn't have... it would have taken teachers and peers to show me, look, you can record yourself in GarageBand. This is how it works. And then, you know, that changes to Logic. And yeah, I think it's just, it's definitely a bit of a generational thing that is getting better. Like you say, with young people now, I see a lot of young women self-producing on social media and people who I gig with. And I guess I'm happy that I'm there now. And the journey for me came whenever it came. But yeah, lockdown did come at a good time for me. I managed to get my head around it all-ish. I'm still learning, of course, but, you know, at least I know what a side chain is now and why it's important to double the snare, stuff like that. Whereas I just wouldn't, I mean, that's sort of more production-y things than writing, but...
But it feeds into it, doesn't it? Because one of the things that I found, I think when I was in my early 20s and I had aspirations to be a songwriter, I managed to get demos in front of a few people. But I now know, looking back on it, that my demos just sounded like shit demos. And I still think the songs were good. Mm. And in my kind of ideological viewpoint that I had at the time, I was like, can't they hear that the song is good? Is that not enough for them? But no, it's not. You need to be able to present your ideas correctly. It's like the equivalent of handing in a CV on a handwritten scrappy bit of paper, and more and more now. So it's kind of important so that your ideas come across. And has that directly facilitated the work that you do for publishers in the children's songwriting sphere?
Has what directly?
Your ability to produce demos and to come with a kind of complete idea.
Definitely. Yeah, because before, so when I started my master's, I got back into writing, songwriting. But again, it was only piano and voice. And I did that through, you know, the first few months of lockdown. I know someone who runs a company who do children's singing videos and songs. And I used to be in a band with someone. I wrote the lyrics. He wrote the music. I also put him in touch with this songwriting company. And I saw him write a lot of songs for them over the 2 years we were doing this band. And so lockdown came, and it was 4 years after that, after me calling myself a lyricist. And I was like, do you know what? I'm writing my own songs now. So why don't I get in touch and say, I'm songwriting too? And I got a sort of quite disheartening response back, saying like, what you're doing is you're writing a melody and a piano part. But, you know, for these kids' songs, you need to be able to really work your way around Logic. You need to be able to write drum beats and drum fills and bass lines and know how to fill a song out with, you know, mid parts and counter melodies and riffs. And I was just like, oh, dear. Well, I guess I don't know how to do that. So it's a valid response. And then again, my ex at the time, because we were in lockdown, spending a lot of time together, he was like, no, that's bullshit. You can do that. You can write a bass line. He was like, you're great at melodies and harmony. And I thought I wasn't, because no one had ever told me that I was. Really, a couple of people maybe said I had a good ear and I thought it was fluke and I liked it, but I thought I felt like a shit musician. I was never good at musicianship. You know, I couldn't sight read. I didn't know what a seventh chord sounded like. I didn't know there were different types of seventh chords. I wouldn't have known about augmented or diminished chords. Like, I didn't know anything. And he was just like, yeah, of course, you just try and write a bass line, see what happens. He taught me drum beats. So that was actually a really useful way into Logic, to know how to write drum parts. And then I learned about sort of vaguely how I made up bass. I listened to music. Of course, we all listen to music. I just didn't put two and two together and trust myself that with all the years of listening to music, I may be able to write a vaguely sort of accurate or interesting bass part. And, you know, if in doubt, just get the bass to play the root notes, because loads of bloody bands do that. Anyway, and then from there, I guess it was self-teaching, chatting to friends, peers, and I'm using that word loads today. It's basically other musicians, but not ones I would consider friends, because we wouldn't go for a pint, just the two of us. But your colleagues sounds a bit formal, so I call them peers. But anyway,
I think that's good. Yeah,
Yeah.
It's less clunky than associate.
Oh, associate. Do you know anyone who says that?
Oh, I do all the time. No, I'm joking. You would in another profession, though.
Yes.
But it's a weird thing. We do a lot of kind of downtime and hanging on our job, don't we?
Yeah.
So you have
but
these
still,
weird...
still, for me, not quite... enough to call people friends.
Yeah, yeah. You have these weird, quite close relationships with people because you spend Saturday night together.
Yeah.
But it's like, I wouldn't... Well, no, that sounds bad. But it's, I don't know, you kind of build these odd relationships. I think peer is appropriate, yeah.
Yeah, because friend, well, some of them I guess are, it depends how loosely you see friends. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, or people you would be friends with, except you only ever see them at work.
Yeah,
but
I
for
mean,
me, really,
if any people are listening
go,
that applies to,
yeah,
just know, yeah, that's how
we
I,
really
that's
like
how
you.
I see you, as an associate.
And nothing more than a peer.
Do not text me in the week.
Yeah. And don't ask me for a coffee. No, but seriously, the peers who change into friends, if you think about sort of being in a green room on backstage of a gig on a Saturday night, they're the people that I think you'd meet in the week for a walk or a coffee or a pint, just the two of you. For me, that's how I deem a friend, is you're comfortable meeting just the two of you. So with that in mind, I think a lot of my musician friends are peers because... you get on really well at gigs and you love seeing each other, but then you quite rarely or never have made the time to like just meet the two of you.
Sure. I think the other side of that is that we have really high expectations for how well you should get along with a work colleague that people in other industries just don't.
Yeah.
Because it's very rare that I find myself working with someone and I think, oh, wow, we didn't get on. It's very rare. Whereas all of my friends that don't work in music, that work in more quote unquote traditional professional settings are like... I like maybe 10% of the people in my job.
Yeah.
But I get on
so
with
true.
Everybody for the purpose of it. And it's really interesting that we have that high expectation.
But I guess we learn you only
get a lot of gigs if you have kind of learnt the code of getting on with people in that scenario, I guess.
Yeah. And also we've got such shared experiences. I mean, I think, don't know, playing music at a certain age, you just like, you do have a really shared experience, whereas you can be in a job where you've done completely different degrees at very different universities and maybe also come from really different backgrounds. So in the classical world, well, I mean, I hate it, but ABRSM, who are an examining board, as you know, but for the non-musicians out there, you can do exams with them when you're at any point in graded exams in instruments. So if people say I've got grade 5 in piano or grade 5 in trumpet or grade 6 in singing, it's usually with ABRSM, who are the biggest board, associated board of, well, anyway, something, music. And part of their exams, you have to sight read. So sight reading is looking at notes for the first time on a sheet of paper and singing them. It's incredibly hard, especially, again, if you don't come from like a traditional classical music background where you're used to reading the notes. A lot of people learn by ear, like I did. And when I was writing my songs, like I said, I was in my late teens. If someone had said, like, what chords are those? I wouldn't have known. And that stayed with me right till quite recently, when people go, what key do you do it in? And I just go, I don't know, the original key. I don't know what key that is. But, you know, I know my melody starts on an F. And sometimes I don't even know that. I just sing it. And people can make you feel stupid for not knowing that kind of stuff. But really, it's like a painter. You know, you don't have to know all the names of the colours on the palette if you're using them beautifully. Not saying that vocally I'm painting beautifully, but
I've heard you paint beautifully, Amy.
I can. Sometimes I can. I'll give myself that. During my opera undergrad, I wasn't very good at musicianship. So I wasn't good at the musicianship classes we had, where we had to identify chords by ear. And of course, a lot of instrumentalists were way better because they do have to read more dots and they do have to know which note their fingers are physically going on to make mm-hmm. that noise.
Yeah.
Whereas for a singer, you know, you control it internally, so you can't see where you're...
As a guitarist, you know if you put your finger on fret 3 on the E string, you know you're playing a G. You don't need to have good ears to do that. I mean, that's certainly been the case for me. But it's an interesting thing that I have witnessed a lot, is the effect that that has on, especially singers in a traditional education environment. It's quite hard to break because there are kind of certain reasons that it proliferates itself like this. But it's hard not to take a hit to your kind of self-worth, isn't it? When you feel like you don't fit in the top of the hierarchy.
Yeah.
And also the thing that you're making music with is your body. It's hard not to take feedback personally. And I've always been very keenly aware of that when I've been the person giving the feedback. It's kind of tough, you know. You've also got to do it with integrity, and you have got to be quite objective sometimes. But it's hard to kind of be part of that system. And not necessarily never, operatic or classical, but it's hard to be kind of part of that system and part of the system that's doing it to people and trying to figure out how it can be done in a more compassionate way, but also in a way that still has the rigor and still prepares people. I don't yet know what the answer is, man. But
well, and that's encouraging, because...
Yeah. It's really hard. It's really hard to grade people, right, and give them objectively a grade that they consider a low grade, especially if you're teaching at a good place where everybody else is getting spectacularly high grades that are way above the average. And then you have to sit them down and they go, you've always been really nice to me. I'm like, well, yeah, it's because I think you're doing great. That's still, if I have to put you against this set of criteria, which I occasionally do, but that isn't what I think about you as a person. But that's a lot to get your head around as an 18-year-old, isn't it? In fact, that's a lot to get your head around at any age.
Yeah, and you do just end up seeing it as a failure.
Yeah, it's kind of tough because you walk out the room as the person that's done it. You're like, I know all of this. I just hope that that person will keep coming back, and then we'll be able to look back on it. But yeah, it's tricky. Anyway, that made me think of that. I was ruminating.
No, I like that, but it's true. You know, we both teach, and obviously we've been through a system of being taught. And it is important, I think, when you feel there's something like a big hole in your knowledge, which for me was musicianship and note reading. And it still is, you know, a transcription would take me ages. No one, for these kids' songs I do, they just go on Logic and they end up as WAVs and then they get mastered. I never have to provide a score for them. And thank God, because it would just take me ages. I'd freak out. I wouldn't. Even a week after I've written something, if I come back to it, I can't remember the chord progression. I have to sort of solo the bass line and play the piano and be like, oh, right, okay, you know, this is in E and I've just done a classic, whatever, 1-4-5, whatever it is. I can't do that for every song, sadly, so sometimes I have to think outside the box and use different chords. But the rock school syllabus, I guess you know that one, is much better for singers because you have scales and you have intervals and you have arpeggios and the learner has to know what note they start on. So even something as simple as that is just, helpful, I think.
Well, there you go. Hope you enjoyed that chat with Amy. I certainly did. Thanks very much, Amy. Before I sign off, I just wanted to mention that previous guest Sam Delaney has a new book out, Sort Your Head Out, Mental Health Without All the Bollocks. I would recommend it as a brilliant read or brilliant listen on Audible. Sam's written a really, I think, important but very funny book that is super honest, super useful, not just for blokes, but particularly, I think, for blokes who maybe want a way into talking about mental health and some of those bits and bobs, but in a way that isn't too full of the psychobabble that some people find a little bit off-putting. So, yeah, I just wanted to recommend that. 5 stars plus, Sam Delaney, Sort Your Head Out, Mental Health Without All the Bollocks. Go and get a copy now. Right. Well, that's it from me. Look forward to chatting to you again soon on Everyone's an Expert. Bye now.